Welcome to this week's Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. In this week's Hangout, I chatted to Andrew Jaspin, editor of The Conversation. Welcome to Mumbrella House. I'm Tim Burrows and we're live. This week, my guest is Andrew Jaspin, editor of The Conversation. Also joining us is my colleague Cameron Boone, who'll be looking after the social media for us. Welcome both. Now, Andrew, let's get straight into it. Most people will have heard of The Conversation now that it's been around for 2 years, but for those who haven't, maybe explain the ethos of the site.
Look, first of all, it's great to be with you. I wish it was true that most people know about us. We have gone from 0 to 2 years, in which we've built up now an audience of roughly 800,000 a month uniques, which is pretty good, but I wouldn't say that's most people know about us. Maybe within the circles that you and I mix in, people know about us, but I always think there's a lot of people out there who still don't. In terms of The Conversation, look, I used to edit The Age, and while I was at The Age, I got to know the Vice-Chancellor at Melbourne quite well, Glyn Davis. When I left The Age, end of 2008, 2009, he invited me to go and do some research into really tackling the one fundamental issue I had, which is this. If the media model, which has been around for 150 years or so for newspapers, is falling apart, where are we going to find the good stuff, the good information, which is critical for society in terms of actually having informed citizens? Where's that going to come from? Now, I'm not saying that has happened. That was just a hypothesis I put forward. And with that in mind, as I wandered around the university, I actually stumbled upon the answer, or an answer, not the answer, an answer, which is, why don't we connect the university with its enormous repositories of research, of knowledge, of expertise, with journalists, and actually get that out in a timely way and a relevant way to the news cycle, actually engage with the here and now, to explain the complex issues of our times, be those climate change or population issues or whatever. And if you think about it, you know, those people are ideally suited because each academic is what's known as a subject matter expert. Now, those subject matter experts used to be called specialists in newsrooms. And every newsroom would have a science correspondent or science team.
And of course, mostly they haven't now.
And what's happened is they've been hollowed out. So virtually all the newsrooms, they've taken specialists out and they've got fewer people, and most of the people are general reporters. General reporters don't have that specialist knowledge. In my virtual newsroom, we currently have 5,000, over 5,000 specialists or experts.
This is people who've already contributed or who could potentially
contribute? No, they already contribute. So what happens when you want to write for The Conversation, you need to go through a registration process, and that registration process has to specify that you're a bona fide a researcher or academic, the institution, the expertise or the relevant expertise you've got, because we only let people write on their areas of specialism. So we have 5,000, over 5,000 now. There are 55,000 academics in Australia. We're never going to get 55,000. In fact, just 5,000 is probably enough. And those people write on every subject. I mean, the word university means the universe of knowledge. So they cover every single area, from the sciences through to the humanities. And that's our newsroom. And when people ask me the question, why have you done well? I could tell you things like, oh, social media and all those kind of stuff. I just don't think it's actually that. I think what it is that people are craving out there information they can trust. And I think because of the very strict protocols we put in place around disclosure of funding, that only experts write on it, people really know, I think people are saying, well, maybe this is what we're looking for. And I think that's been the secret of what we've done. And those people who've stumbled across us, including stumbled upon, then tell their friends. And okay. I just think, frankly, you know, there is no science to it. It's just having a site with trusted information, which is what we're about, actually has great appeal.
And in a second, we'll explore the funding side of things as well, actually, sure. How you make it pay. Just a reminder, if you do want to come in with a question on social media, then either in the comment thread on Mumbrella, or if you're watching this on Mumbrella, or on Twitter with the hashtag Ask Jaspin, our guest is Andrew Jaspin, editor of The Conversation, then Cameron will bring your questions to us. So please do that.
Now, why couldn't you do Ask Andrew? There's a kind of alliteration there.
Well, Ask Andrew, yes, but you know, that's you know us journalists, we like formality, don't we?
Or
we do at times.
You're old school.
Well, how do you feel about
Where's your tie?
How do
you feel, like formality?
Well, that's a very good point. How do you feel about Ask Andy, or is that a step
oh,
too
no,
far?
Oh no, please no. Come on.
we'll settle with Jasper then, I think. So, in order to do this, yes, you have access to all of these academics. Yeah. You still need a team of journalists to help them talk.
We have 15.
In an accessible way. That's expensive. How did you get your funding?
Right, well, the funding has largely come from universities. So we had 5 lead universities who put up money initially to get going. There are core funders. We now have 25, and in Australia there are 39 universities, so we're working, hope to get all 39 in time. We also get funding from some corporates. So our biggest corporate supporter is Commonwealth Bank, who have just been brilliant as a supporter. They have fundamentally helped us with the technology side of the site. We also have between 6 and 8 web developers working, so they've essentially helped us create the platform. We also have a number of others, including Ernst & Young and Cause Chambers, our lawyers who do pro bono work for us. So that they came in. And then the last thing, we got seed funding from the Department of Education federally and the Department of Innovation in Victoria. So those were the 3 pots of money that helped us get going.
And how long are you stable for before you need to worry about funding again?
Well, our funding is pretty stable in the sense that universities are on what's called annuities, so they just, you know, it's like a membership fee. And with government, we're in the process of renegotiating right now. With corporates, we're talking to a lot of new corporates who are interested in what we do. So the real issue is we want to grow what we're doing. So we currently have 2 people in Sydney, 1 in Canberra, a part-time person in fact, we have 2 now because we've got Michelle Grattan there, 1 part-time person in Brisbane. We want to point into Perth, into Adelaide, into Hobart, and we want to do a lot more. And I can run through the other things we want to do, but a big glaring miss that we're doing right now is we're not doing enough on the humanities, the arts, culture, design, that sort of creative area, which includes architecture and things like that. So there's a lot more we want to do. So my role right now, why I'm in Sydney, is to try and actually get more funds so we can do more.
Let's talk about a couple of the things which make you, I think, probably unique. One of them is your traffic light system for writing. Mm. The fact that there's a discipline for any writers, which I've never come across anywhere else in how they write. Maybe you can explain that.
Yes, look, when I told people about this project, they said, good luck. And I said, what do you mean? Well, they said, academics can't write. And not only can't they write, they're ill-disciplined in terms of being timely. You know, they don't understand that actually, you know, you have to get something out while an issue is hot and live, not 6 months later when everybody's moved on. So I said, well, actually, I'm going to actually show you that we can challenge these 2 myths and deal with them. So the first thing we did is we have 14 editors plus me, and they work on each section. Now, the problem is that we cannot copy edit every single piece of information. We just haven't got the bandwidth to do it. So we built what we call a safe writing platform, and into that, we use an algorithm, which is called the Flesch Kincaid, which actually tracks as you write whatever reading age you want it to go out to. So you can just set the thing at, you know, an 8-year-old, or we've set it at a 16-year-old. And the reason for 16 is not that we're aiming for 16-year-olds, although we want 16-year-olds to read it. It's just that's a good, plain English, simple English, which will attract the widest possible audience. So as they write in it, there's a traffic light system which says language too complex, and it gives tips on, you know, how to simplify it. It could be too complex, or the sentences could be too long. And so what that does is it means it's a labor-saving device in a sense for our editors. However, we don't just leave it to that. Each editor then actually reads through it again. And the beauty of our system is that nothing is published until the author says, actually, that edit is fine, or you need to change this before you can publish it. And they have the final say on the headline, the picture caption, the edit, etc. And only when the author says, good to go, can we publish? Now that sometimes slows down our process because sometimes we've edited the whole thing, but we have to send a note back saying, is this okay? And they might not come back for a couple of hours because they're teaching or busy or whatever. And, you know, Misha, the news editor, will say, where's that story? I want it, you know, up. And the editor will say, I'm still waiting for clearance. So we can't do anything without that. And the beauty of that system is we don't have that thing where readers get in touch with the author to say, you've got this wrong, or the author then has to go around explaining that, you know, there was an error in the article, wasn't theirs, it was put in by a sub-editor. How many times, Tim, have you heard people say, oh, not my fault, the sub-editor.
The journals blame the subs, and the subs used to blame the printers.
That's right,
back when they were.
All that's gone, all that's gone. So, and by the way, I love the simplicity of our model that we don't print anymore, so we don't put a penny into manufacturing and distribution and all that sort of stuff. All we focus on is good ideas.
Well, let's touch on, you've just mentioned distribution. One of the other, to me, interesting things about the distribution model is anyone can republish your content.
Now, we're sort of members of something called the Open Access Movement. And the Open Access Movement believes largely that knowledge should be free and knowledge should be shared. And that's not just within here in Australia, but globally. So we've signed up to something called Creative Commons, which was something that was founded at MIT in the US, which essentially says that anybody can use our content as long as they don't rewrite it or re-edit it, because then you just introduce the very errors we've tried not to do. So if you look at our site, and anybody out there watching this should know this, if you go to our site and you click on republishing, it says steal our stuff. We actually encourage people to say, look, we do not have copyright here. Everything we have is knowledge for society. Anybody can use it. All you need to do is attribute the author, the institution that they work for, and the fact that it was first came from the conversation. Otherwise, it's free for you to use. Now, the beauty of that model is our stuff is appearing everywhere. It's appearing in newspapers,
and declaration
online.
Of interest we use.
Yeah, you use it on Umbrella, but Business Spectator uses it, The Drum uses it. The Age is even using it, despite the fact that, for example, Michelle Grattan left, it's back on their site. So, and that, to me, is the model that I want to really develop, which is essentially putting good, high-quality information into the public arena for everyone to share.
We've touched on Michelle Grattan. She was one of your, I suppose, most high-profile signings today. So, you know, well-known from her long time in Canberra reporting for Fairfax Papers. What's your thinking behind that hire? What does that say about the ambitions of the conversation?
Okay, well, first of all, when you say she's the most high-profile signings you've had, we haven't had any other signings, you know, and I doubt there will be any more signings. Michelle was really the exception to the rule, and there's a couple of things. First of all, I thought she was just absolutely fantastic when I was editing, and she was my political editor at The Age. There is nobody as scrupulous as she is when it comes to the facts. She is known in the industry. If you talk to any MP, they will tell you about getting the call at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. You know, each one of them has a wonderful Michelle Grattan story about how they were just about to go to bed or whatever, and they would get the call from Michelle. And Michelle would always say, there'd be no sort of informal, jocular, sorry to get you up, or, you know, are you okay to talk? She'd just say, now, I need it to check. Have I got this right when you said this? I want to be quite sure. And she will not publish anything until it's checked. And she is meticulous in that. Anyway, she has been at Fairfax. She's edited the Canberra Times, one of their titles. She's been at the Fin, she's been at the Sydney Morning Herald, she's been at The Age. And she was getting concerned, I don't want to put words in her mouth here, but she was getting concerned about the direction that Fairfax was taking The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. And she said to me, is there any possibility, if I was to leave The Age, to write for you? And I said, well, we have very strict rules, which is you can't write for us unless you're actually with a university. She said, well, I actually am an adjunct already with the University of Canberra. I said, well, that's fine. Let's speak to the Vice-Chancellor. And the Vice-Chancellor then actually has formally engaged her. So he's engaged her. So the University of Canberra is her employer. Just to be clear, we don't pay for Michelle. But the University of Canberra actively encourages, as does every university, for their people to write for the media. Essentially, because every university is funded by the public, The view is we ought to give something back to the public, and the best way to do that is to share our knowledge or expertise or whatever.
Now you touched on...
So she works for the University of Canberra, she writes for us, she's based still at Parliament, and she does analysis for us, she does news, and she's quite different to a lot of our academics, because other academics who might write on political analysis do so from usually their university office or whatever, where she actually has a room there in Parliament. And so she's, if you like, has got a front row seat on what's happening. And this is going to be an important election year, very important election year. And she'll play a major role in that. But she won't be the only member. We have a very big political team led by Rory Cahill, who's our politics editor. And he and this team have put together a big plan for this year. So we're going to do some quite exciting stuff over the year ahead, ahead of the election. And, you know, Michelle will play a role there. But she is critical in the sense of getting an academic to go to Parliament is just a no-no, where she actually has a ticket and a seat right there in the press gallery.
Well, in a moment, maybe one more question from me, and then we'll cross over to Cameron to see what's being said on social media. So a reminder that the hashtag is AskJaspern. You've touched upon it there. You suggested that Michelle Grattan had questions over the direction Fairfax was taking. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a former editor of The Age, a Fairfax title. You wrote an opinion piece just a few days ago in which you suggested that what we were seeing was The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald effectively merging and moving down market in the style of the Daily Mail in the UK. All things which Fairfax vigorously refuted. I think one of them even suggested that you'd tried it with The Age and failed, were the words of Gary Linnell. Now that you've had a chance to see The Age and the Herald in compact format, what sort of job do you think they've done?
Look, just before I answer your question, what was interesting is that Gary Linnell, you know, obviously wounded by my comments, you know, made that rather disparaging remark. What was interesting was a few days later, Michelle Grattan left. Now she's not leaving to a mid-market paper, you know, publication. And a week after Michelle announced, out walked Catherine Murphy and Lenore Taylor to The Guardian. You know, these people are actually voting with their feet. They're actually saying that under the direction of the current people running it, and by the way, they've done some good things. I think I need to be really clear, and I'll come back to that in a second. But the editorial voice or direction that is being taken here is not one that it finds sympathy with certain more experienced and thoughtful members of the combined editorial teams, which is why they're leaving. And by the way, my understanding is from Kath Viner is that, you know, if she had 100 jobs, you know, they would be filled like that with Fairfax people, because they all are desperate to get out. Well, not all, but a lot of them.
Now one thing, because journalists are always unhappy wherever they work, and they always leave. Yeah.
No, absolutely. But I think there is a little bit more here going on. Now, let me answer your question. I think, first of all, and I've got a copy here of Today's Age.
That's Today's Age.
Yeah. Look, first of all, I'm really delighted that this management had the balls, frankly, to make this decision. I think it's terrific because, frankly, there's no point publishing a paper which is unreadable in the sense that, you know, I travel on the tram every day to work, and so do a lot of people in Melbourne or tram. You just cannot physically read the paper. So why would you buy a paper if in your commuting time in the morning you can't even read it? So people just gave up. And a lot of people then just moved to their phones or tablets or whatever. So that's the good news. However, I think it's 10 years too late. And this is the real problem facing Fairfax. And you can't blame the current management. You can't blame, you know, Greg Hywood or Gary Linnell or all the other people there, because I think if they'd had it their way, they would have changed a long time ago. But a decision was made in 2006-07 when I was going to shrink the paper, because I just felt The Age was way too big when I was editing it. And I wanted to do the same thing as the New York Times, as you know, which is a sort of narrow. And in the UK, the Daily Telegraph does the same thing. We couldn't go to a Berliner, which is The Guardian, because that involves building new presses.
That's
entirely.
The mid-size, that's sort of the, between yeah. compact and
bulge. We couldn't do that because you have to build a new press. And The Guardian spent £50 million building a new press just to do that. So you've essentially, on the current presses, you can do broadsheet or tabloid. And just to remind you, that's a tabloid and that's a broadsheet, so it's just half of a broadsheet. We were going to do something different, and that was agreed by David Kirk when he was the CEO, and then it was cancelled by the next CEO, which is Brian McCarthy. So that's the kind of record that Fairfax have had. They've just not had what I call a sure hand on the tiller in terms of where it goes.
To be clear now, though, with the current management, can you see anything that you would do differently to what they're doing? You know, a lot of what they're doing now feels like logical, sensible
it
things.
It is logical. So just to be clear, this change is not driven by an editorial reasoning. It's really driven by cost cutting. So what they're going to do is shut the printing plants in Sydney and in Melbourne and outsource it to their regional plants. It's about combining two staffs into one. So if you read this paper now, it's full of stuff from Sydney. They now call themselves Fairfax. They tell Fairfax rather than tell The Age or Sydney Morning Herald.
They would still put to the fact that they have an editor-in-chief in each city who makes the final decision on what goes in an article paper.
Yeah, but largely speaking, the tone is set now by Gary Linnell in Sydney. So Gary's the effective editor of both papers. He chooses the editors. He largely sets down the agenda. And the agenda is, as senior journalists at The Age and Sydney Morning being briefed, is to actually move the papers into more of a mid-market positioning. So less reliance on the heavy stuff, less reliance on politics, and a greater emphasis on lifestyle, on crime, on showbiz.
Now, mid-market is something that Fairfax would reject that description.
Of course, yeah, of course they would. Because, you know, if they go too close to the Herald Sun, they fly too close to the Herald Sun or the Daily Telegraph, they're dead. So you have to keep some separation between the two. But what's happened is they actually don't know what they are anymore. So they're no longer like broadsheet and they're not tabloid, they're compact. But what does compact actually mean? And as a result of that, I think what I felt when I've read the paper is a feeling that it's kind of directionless. It's kind of, it's underwhelming. It's not one thing or another. Now, you and I both know, because we were in the UK at the time, when The Independent went tabloid, and they just decided on a completely different approach. Now, my understanding is they did think of that, both the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and it was rejected because readers said, we don't like that, we want to keep it as it is. The problem with readers is readers are very conservative. They just know what they've got, and they say, we just don't want it to change. And if you're going to take it tabloid, can you make it look just like the broadsheet? Well, that's not enough. And I think that's a central problem now within Fairfax. When you lose Lenore Taylor, Catherine Murphy, Michelle Grattan, David Marr, a lot of the marquee names, there is a loss of sureness about what actually does Fairfax now stand
for. Before we move on from Fairfax again, one other point that Gary Linnell made was the move to mid-market, he says, was something that you tried under The Age and failed. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair summary?
Look, I don't actually know Gary. My understanding is, you know, his real area of interest is crime rather than politics. I'm actually, and he doesn't know me, and it's just a cheap remark by him. I actually edited The Observer, right? Now, when I edited
the UK Sunday newspaper.
Yeah, and I sat on the board of the Guardian Media Group as well, Guardian Newspapers Limited. So I've actually worked at a higher level than Gary will ever work at, editorially. I've edited The Scotsman, Scotland Sunday. I won't go through all the other papers I've edited, including editing The Age as opposed to The Daily Telegraph, which he edited, which, as we know, is a mid-market tabloid. There is no way, there is nothing in me that is about mid-market. I'm actually a serious journalist, which is why, I mean, how would you suggest Michelle Grattan would move to somebody who's a mid-market person? I mean, it's just... in fact, I don't want to spend any more time on it. It's just a nonsense.
Now, time is short because we want to take some questions. Let's cross over to Cameron. Cameron, anything coming in from social media? And you can use the hashtag AskJaspen if you want to come in with a question. Cameron.
We've got one question from David Barrett, who says, first off, congratulations on the conversation. It's lessened my dependence on the Economist and New Scientist, but would you consider moving into TV news, which at the moment is largely unwatchable?
Wow. hadn't thought about that. This is a form of TV news I'm slightly more happy with. The one thing which is great, and for people watching this, you should know this is very low tech, and it's exactly the way I would want to do anything. You know, I do not want to have studios and expensive equipment. The way you're doing it now is exactly the right way. We'd love to do more video and more audio. It's really just a funding issue to a certain extent, not entirely. So would we like to do TV? Yes, but if we did do it, we wouldn't do it on our own. My view is focus on what you're best at and collaborate to do the rest. So, you know, we might do it with Umbrella, we might do it with the ABC, we might do it with SBS, we might do it with who knows, but we're never going to launch our own TV station.
Cameron, do you want to come in with another question?
Absolutely. Saskia Pickles has asked, do you have any career advice for a print journalist who is newly freelance, who is trying to get work in digital?
I think I know Saskia. Okay, well, look, this is the key thing, Saskia, and anybody who's a journalist, is you have to stop worrying about the distribution platform, whether it's digital or print or magazines or whatever, and you just have to be a good journalist. And what do I mean by a good journalist? You have to be curious, you have to have lots of ideas, you need to read widely, you need to ask questions, you need to be up to speed with the news, and then when you meet, for example, Tim, if he was looking for somebody, you need to impress him that you're actually switched on and you'll be able to get stories into that channel, whatever it may be. So I wouldn't worry too much about the digital aspect. I just try and make sure that you are a good, grounded journalist and sharper than the rest.
Now, I'm conscious that we probably only have 2 or 3 minutes left, so I'm going to throw in another question, which is, you've touched upon The Guardian. The Guardian, as we've said, are coming. They're here in Australia now. They're hiring right now. How do you think they'll do?
Well, look, right now, in terms of uniques, they have 38 million worldwide. Their biggest market is, I think, now the US or the UK anyway. They're big in both. They've got 45 people in the US. They're going to start, as I understand it, unless you've heard otherwise, with around 10 to a dozen here in Australia. And of those, I think they're going to be hiring half locally, and they're bringing people in from London. But they claim of that 38 million, they've got 1.5 million uniques already per month, that is, reading them. So that's actually already pretty good. Although, if you look closely at it, Tim, you'll see, we've done a bit of analysis on this, they largely go to The Guardian for EPL, Premier League football, and also for the arts, you know, because The Guardian are very good on film and TV and popular culture. So those are the two key things they go for. So I think what they're thinking is, if we've already got those two bases covered, why don't we cover local politics, which is another area, and they might do local sport as well, given that that's a big driver for them. So I reckon what they're trying to do is build a global brand, and I think they're going to be very successful at that. The problem is, as they're growing the brand, they actually haven't got the revenue to sustain it. So the big question mark, which, by the way, this is not rocket science, it's talked about all the time in the UK, is what is the long-term viability of The Guardian? Because right now, it gets a lot of its cash from complementary companies that it owns, where the profits are ploughed back into The Guardian and The Observer. The question is that sustainable into the future? But what they are doing is growing something, and they do see a market gap here in Australia because of the way Fairfax is moving into a different direction, they feel has opened up an opportunity for them.
Now, finally, because we are almost out of time, what next for the conversation?
Well, largely speaking, we just want to do the job better. There's a lot more we want to do. I've sort of touched on more editors. We want to launch some new sections. We want to do more on sport. We want to do more on the creative design, architecture areas, and the arts broadly. And lastly, we've been invited by a number of people to say, you know, would you be interested in taking this model to the rest of the world? So that's an area which is also interests us.
It's in the public domain that the UK could be one of those places.
The UK is, look, for us, the easiest countries to move into are English-speaking countries. Where's The Guardian in? The Guardian's in the UK, US and Australia. The obvious ones for us to be looking at would be UK and US.
And can you talk about the UK launch today?
I can't, no. And the reason is that we're in talks with a number of universities and others, but that's really, we're still at the stage of actually talking it through. And I know there's been a leak saying that we are doing something. That's not definite yet. We haven't actually, you know, signed anything. We're just in talks. And if actually those talks come to something, yes, we would love to be there. But that's still, I reckon, sort of a matter of, you know, months, if not half a year away.
Time, unfortunately, has beaten us. So thank you very much to Cameron for joining us on the social media. And also thank you to Andrew Jaspin, editor of The Conversation. Thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure, Tim. Great talking to you.
That was me chatting to Andrew Jaspin, editor of The Conversation. More soon. Toodle-pip.